Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Q Commentator. My name's Nick Heath and thank you for joining me for another episode as I speak to another broadcasting voice in sport that is synonymous with so many great moments, particularly, of course, if you are a British athletics and Olympics fan. Thanks again to all of you who are tuning in regularly. Great to have you coming back. Let me know if you're enjoying the series. Please do via @QCommentator on Twitter or @NickHeathSport, or if you are lovely enough to just take the time to leave a review on iTunes. It means an awful lot to me. It also means that other people that are looking through podcasts will see all of your glowing reviews, the reasons you're tuning in again and again, and perhaps we can welcome more people to the parish. So that would be really wonderful if you can take the time. On to this week's guest then. We need to crack on, because if you're looking at your clock counter, you're going, this is a long one. The Jarrow Arrow, a decorated sportsman who was not only successful on the track, but he's become a bit of a dab hand on the mic as well. Started at Eurosport and Channel 4, well, as you'll hear, that was a start that was as deep end as off the deep end goes, really. I thought his training had started at the BBC, but you'll hear how all of that came about. Calls himself a child of broadcasting, given the company he was keeping that were clearly voices of a generation, the likes of David Coleman, Jim Rosenthal, etc. Vocabulary that is used for different races, so much detail in this one, and an interesting chat about what sport he was asked to have a crack at after 2012. So listen out for that. It is all here, and it is a longer one than usual. I listened back to it today, and to be honest, I struggled to take anything out of it. So you can call that lazy editing or being entirely self-indulgent or a combination of both of those things. But either way, it's all here for you. Recorded during June 2020 during lockdown. We were a few hundred miles apart, but thanks to Zencastr and a FaceTime call, well, we were at least able to see each other and speak in decent audio quality. There's so much good stuff here. Without further ado, after a good few months, if not years, in the offing, gives me great pleasure to say Q Commentator Steve Cram.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, not bad at all. In the times we're all going through, I'm very fortunate to live in Northumberland, which it's an odd summer. Normally, I'm not here very much. I'm not here very much generally, but I'm getting used to. I've lived here 10 years, and I found out more about the place in the last 3-4 months than in the previous 10 years. But it's great.
Good. Well, I'm so grateful for you joining us. Needless to say, you will be known to most people, obviously, for your career as a world record holding distance runner, a world champion, double European champion, Olympic silver medalist, 3-time Commonwealth Games gold medalist, former BBC Sports Personality of the Year winner. But I can say that with full acknowledgement that I know, you know, a lot of these things, having grown up and seen you win some of those titles. But as we well know, sort of time moves on, and to many people, you'll just be the voice of athletics.
Yes, that's history. It's ancient history, yes.
And the London Marathon on their TVs. So, I mean, does that sort of sit okay with you, or do you feel the need to have, you know, the odd medal in your back pocket just in case?
No, you know, it's... I have to tell my kids what I did, you know. And you know, my daughter's 30-something. Look, you know, we all go through phases in our lives, don't we? And you kind of, people will know you for different parts of that life. Obviously, people go through different jobs and, you know, they don't always carry what they did 10 years ago into the job they do now. People see you for what they understand and know about you. And that's cool. That's good. You know, I mean, inevitably, but, you know, sport has a an enduring feature to it, which is usually, as you said, if you've grown up watching it, it's a bit like music, isn't it? I always liken sport to music. You never forget the music that you grew up with. And to be honest, what you were taught about, you know, I was very young, but, you know, the Beatles, but my mum and dad played the Beatles loads and played Elvis Presley and played Jim Reeves and played, you know, so even though I can't say, oh yeah, I grew up with Elvis Presley, but so it's all about, you know, I think sport and music are very similar like that, you know, and there's no reason why there's certain music that happens today I really enjoy and into, but yeah. I'm not going to forget what happened a while back. So there's a lot of that, but yes, for some people, that you know, the commentary is particularly younger folk, you know, that's how they know me.
Well, it's always a privilege to be in the company of someone who has, you know, achieved what you have and the titles that you've gotten. And I tip my hat to you and respect the incredible career you've had as an athlete. That goes without saying. But you know, it is time, I guess, for Q Commentator to draw a thin veil across that, which feels slightly odd. Because clearly I'm interested in your work as a commentator after you hung up the running shoes in 1994. So where did the journey into broadcasting begin, and were you doing any during your competitive years?
Well, if you have a successful sports career, you hang around the media a lot, and actually I probably did that more than most. Obviously Brendan Foster was a mentor from an athletic point of view from when I was a kid, and Brendan was working for the BBC, and I got to meet and mix a little bit more in his world. Probably a little more than I might have done had I not had that relationship, and actually that then turned into something a little bit more. It actually helped my athletics career, because in those days the federations weren't great at once I went to the Olympics and I'd been to a couple of championships, particularly Moscow in 1980. You know, you realize that you train hard for these big events, and then you get put in an Olympic village or a world championship village and they're not the most conducive places for getting the best performance out. You know, these days you try to, everyone knows about how you're going to maximize your chances of performing at the highest level. So that's what you're eating, how you're sleeping, where you are. And I think people like Seb were very much ahead of the game on that. So I was learning from him. And also, you know, I realized that often the 1500 was the last event and people were partying. So BBC, Brent, they used to book nice hotels. I realized that once I was earning enough money to become a little bit more independent and make my own decisions, or at least want to spend money on my chances of performing better. So what I started doing was, they often had plans much more advanced than the federations did, and I would book a hotel or book a room in their hotel once I knew, because they were often close to the venue. You know, they had plans, and so yeah, you know, it cost me money, but that's what I did. And so I started to rub shoulders even more at the major championships from 83 onwards in Helsinki when I won the world champs. So I would not be at the stadium every day. You're not as an athlete, but I'd meet Brendan and Coleman and Pickering in the restaurant afterwards when they've come back from the track, and they'd be talking about everything that happened. And inevitably, they're also talking about television, how it works, and producer and the editor and the camera this and this. And it was all nonsense to me at the time. But over the years, I kind of got a level of understanding that I think was way above perhaps what a normal sports person would have. So it's a long answer to your question, but I think it's important to say that I was kind of entrenched in that world a fair bit. And so the next stage of that, coming towards the end of your career, again, Brendan by then had a company that were it was now called Film Nova, and they had a TV production element. And they I'm just checking you're still hearing me because you've gone paused.
Sorry, I am.
Yes, you are.
I'm just trying to stop my WhatsApps from buzzing through my phone.
That's all right.
Carry on.
Technology getting in the way. I'm just dealing with a cat who keeps walking across here. But Film Nova gave me the chance to just do a little bit. You know, they managed to film a few things, athletic stuff, and I wasn't going to run in a couple of them, so I ended up doing a bit of punditry, if you like. And so that was my first step. And then, but the key thing was actually more by accident. A guy who had been the head of sport at BBC, a guy called Alan Hart, had become the, I think he was chairman of Eurosport. Anyway, he was very high up in Eurosport at the time. And Eurosport was a bit new then, 1994, 1995. Mm-hmm. I was at the aforementioned BBC Sports Personality of the Year. We were having a drink, we were chatting. He's going, "What are you doing?" I sort of said, "I think I've retired, but I'm not sure," because I never actually announced it, but deep down I knew. He said, what are you thinking of doing?" I said, "No idea." Da, 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 da. And he, out of the blue, he just said, "Do you fancy doing a bit of commentating?" And I went, "No, I've done a bit of TV and pundit," because that's not what you think, is it? You think I'm happy to go in the studio and talk about athletics, but commentary is a job. Mm. You know, that's what. It's a specific skill.
Yeah, and so you recognise the difference between the punditry side and the commentary side.
Yeah, absolutely. And
Steve removes a cat.
Yes. and it was almost by accident, and I won't bore you with the details, but it happened at about the same time I'd been talking to somebody else, who gave me what turned out to be a great piece of advice, although I didn't appreciate it at the time, which is often the case with things, isn't it? And this person did work in the world of broadcasting. I'm not going to say who it was, but said, "Look, if you ever feel as though think," and he said, "use the analogy of your running career. Don't think that you need to go in, you know, you don't go diving into the Olympic Games and do well, you know.
Yeah.
You actually have he says your running career was about learning you're a local level and building up and getting good at that. And then you advance to the next level." And he said, "and actually, you know, in your running career as well, you did it for the love of it. And then eventually it became your living." And that bit of advice was ring, because Alan said, "We don't pay very well, but it's live sport and you learn a lot." And yeah. I also thought, yeah, you're a sport, you know, that there was certainly going to be British viewers, but it wasn't BBC. It wasn't going to be millions of people watching it. So yeah, I jumped in at the deep end. So that was in the December, and I did my first commentary, which was a disaster, by the way.
Yeah. So what was that?
In May, it was in France. It was in Paris. It was in a small stadium because they were building the new stadium for the World Cup in '98. So it was a very same area, Saint Denis, North Paris. The Paris sort of, you know, Grand Prix athletics. And this was slightly
odd.
So
what year are we talking now?
We're talking 95. Yeah.
95, yeah.
And I was working, thankfully, one of the reasons I said yes to doing it was I knew I was going to work with Tim Hutchings. Tim was a good mate of mine, good athlete as well, fourth in the Olympics and silver medalist world cross country, or top level athlete, but had had 3 years of working already. And I thought, well, okay, I've got a friend. and for the first event, we prepped. That's the other thing, by the way, in athletics. See, football, if you're a footballer and you move into football commentary, they're playing football, right?
Yeah.
I'm a 1500 meter runner. I don't do the pole vault. You know, it's athletics. So I realized I was going to have to do a little bit more homework than perhaps I realized.
At what point did you realize this?
About 2 days before.
Excellent.
You kind of go, well, you get the start list, you know, and you kind of, well, I know him and I know him, but who's that? You know, because in all those events, you know, you've got 11, 12 competitors and, you know, there's going to be four or five of them who this could be their first Grand Prix meeting. They could be on the way up. You don't know. You know, their best is only 5.54 meters, and you know they've once competed in the French Championships, and now they get so you suddenly have to go, right, I need, who is this? So this is pre-internet, so you couldn't just Google somebody. So I realised, Tim had given me a few tips about there's a lot of statisticians in our sport. There are publications. So I realised that very early on that this wasn't just about turning up and starting to talk. You have to prep and you have to. That didn't stop it being disastrous, though, because Tim's advice was, look, when we go on air, I'll don't worry about all the buttons and things. I'll just, you know, I'll tell you, guys are going to be talking in your ears. You know, that's the big thing you don't realize. It's live. You just need to make sure that we have ad breaks. They'll count us into an ad break. You know, you must stop talking. But he said, I'll do all of that. Just I'll shut you up before we get you all of this sort of thing. And I go, okay. So anyway, we're due on at 8 o'clock. We've prepped. It's chucking it down with rain. I mean, I'll never forget this. It was deluge of rain. And I'm telling this this story because it's pertinent to the rest of my career. It's chucking it down with rain. Due on air at 8 o'clock. The French Open was on Eurosport. The program was meant to be the program before us. Roland Garros just up the road. And
so there's not much happening in the rain there either.
Rain had stopped play. Rain had stopped play. So they're showing some replays on Eurosport. So when you do, when you work in broadcasting, you have to be ready for anything. We didn't have a thing, what's called return feed. So we never do on Eurosport. That's money. You know, always depends who you're working for in broadcasting. So
it
I didn't.
It does, yeah.
We had no idea what was going out on air, or we were just waiting for the queue at 8 o'clock. At about 7:45, Tim decides, right, we're ready, we're all prepped, we're all good. I'm going to head off to the loo. I'll not be long. Do you want to bring your sandwich back? Anything? I went, yeah, sure. So off he goes, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at this pole vaulter I've never heard of. I'm looking at my prep sheets and trying to work. And out on the track at the time, there was a women's 5000 happening, which was kind of a. Wasn't in the main program, but it was. It had a few decent athletes in, like one or two, but it was like a lower level race before the main television program was meant to start. However, the pictures were being beamed back at Eurosport headquarters. So some wag, who I'd still to this day would like to find out who it was, at Eurosport thought, they were in a commercial break, thought, you know what? We've got nothing, no more tennis to show. We've done all our replays. We can go early to the athletics. Because look, there's live athletics on the feed. So I literally have a guy two rows along who was the German Eurosport commentator run over, says, Steve, put your cans on. So I put these headphones on, and all I heard was, hello, Athletics, Saint-Denis, we will be live in 10, 9, 8.
And
I'm looking at my German friend who has to go and commentate in his own position and he ran over. And he pressed a button for me, make my mic go live, ran back to his position. So my first commentary words, and you would think I'm joking, I said, hello, I'm Steve Cram. Tim Hutchings is meant to be here, but he's gone to the bathroom. He won't be long. Seriously. Seriously.
That's spectacular.
Now, bear in mind, I had not prepped this 5,000 at all. I didn't even have a proper start list or anything. The only girl I knew in it was a girl called Katrina McKiernan of Ireland, who was in about fifth place. So I spent the next 4 minutes talking about Katrina McKiernan, who actually wasn't even on the camera. What made it even better was Tim came back with a... how long have you got by? You've got an hour, haven't you? This is the end of the story. Tim came back with two cups of coffee and two sandwiches in his arms like this. And I didn't know how to turn my mic off. I didn't know how to cough button or talk back or anything. So I wrote on a piece of paper, we are on air. Okay? And we had those mics that are attached. So it's not a lip mic. It's
proper a headset. Yeah.
And it picks up peripheral sound. And Tim very loudly, and I won't use the F-bomb, but literally said words to the effect of,
you must be effing joking,
which went out on air.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And so that was the start of my commentary. So I figured that would be it. That was my one and only, but I must have done something.
Or at least that it couldn't get any worse, perhaps.
Well, it actually encapsulated a lot of things. One is be ready for anything. Two, if someone can drop you in the mucky stuff, they will drop you in the mucky stuff. three, never rely on your co-commentator, and by the way, live mics are live mics. You know, so actually in 5 minutes, there was a lot of hard lessons, a lot of hard lessons learned.
How did Crash Course Day 1 go, Steve? Yeah, yes. Not bad, thanks.
But they were great. Great experiences, and that 2 years It might
so that was 2 years with Eurosport.
Well, yes, I actually nearly 3 years, I think, because I had a year at 95 and I learned so much, and it was great working with Tim, and we traveled around doing meets and world champs in 95, Jonathan Edwards breaking the world record, and you know, it was a good year. And then 96. So then the BBC were getting a bit more interested, and I started doing a little bit of work for Five Live, but I was still doing television commentary for Eurosport. So at the Olympics, for instance, in Atlanta, I was commentating the athletics, but I was also doing some presenting and some a few Five Live programs. I covered the fencing one day, and I covered the beach volleyball. Great.
Excellent.
I know. So I was learning. You know, I was learning the ropes of that side of things as well. And then the rights moved to Channel 4 for domestic athletics. And Channel 4 in 97 came and said, would you come and commentate? So I commentated then for Channel 4. So that was my first kind of national level, you know, kind of Eurosport is pan-European.
And you were lead commentating with
a guy. There was a production company got the gig to Global, nice guys. Nick Fellows, who you might know, Nick still does a lot of commentary on skiing and all the rest of it. And Nick, it was his company with another guy, and he decided he'd like to commentate. Because I thought at first we were going to bring Tim and I over. And then in the end, it was just me. And I had to commentate with Nick, who had never done athletics. And you know what? To be fair to the Channel 4 lads, or to that production company, Mike Miller, who later became head of sport at BBC, was the commissioning editor. And we introduced a lot of things in that 2 years. Split screens, biogs on screen, what we used to call the flying washing machine, which you've now become used to, you know, like the camera on a rail down the straight. Lots of things. And I kept bumming into Bren and others at the BBC, and they kept going, "No, it's awful. It's horrible. It's, you know," and funny enough, 5 years later, all of those things were the norm. But the BBC were watching all the time, and I got into discussions with them, they and Coleman and others were just basically kept saying, "You're doing a great job. Keep." The head of sport at the time, Brian Barwick, said, "You know, keep doing what you're doing. We'll be coming for you soon," sort of thing.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's interesting. It's funny because then the sort of period before you get to the BBC actually was...
That's where I learned was
where you were doing it. And I think in my head, perhaps, you know, incorrectly, I thought...
You thought I was trained by the BBC, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I mean, obviously, they've got various people under their wing over the years, whether it's Ian Robertson, you know, Sue Barker, Steve Backley, all these sort of people, Jonathan Edwards, Gary Lineker, you know, the sort of way that these people have gone on to have successful careers.
But I think, going back to what I was telling you before, though, that they did in a way, because that whole introduction to some of their top people, Martin Hopkins and John Shrewsbury, and, you know, these guys were legends of what they did in the production. I knew all those people. I knew the head of sport. I had a manager as well through Bren. You know, I was the only kind of, I shouldn't say this, live sportsman. No, I wasn't. I think Bill. So in our stable was Martin Tyler, Alan Parry, John Motson, Bill Beaumont, Brendan. I'm missing a few. Des Lynham.
Okay.
You can imagine.
Very nice company to be keeping.
Right, exactly. So I almost feel as though I'm a child of broadcasting, that, you know, my athletics career was athletics, but I was surrounded by people who worked in broadcasting, people in front of the camera, and I knew people behind the camera. Jim Rosenthal as well, who we were just chatting to the other day. Rosie was in the same stable as well. So we were all socially, we met a lot.
Yeah,
they had a language I didn't necessarily understand, but I learned a lot. So,
yeah.
So while you say I wasn't trained by the BBC, Eurosport, those 2-3 years or 3-4 years of Eurosport and Channel 4 was being dropped in at the deep end. But I actually had an understanding of that world that was probably greater than had I just stepped off the track and somebody said, "Look, do you want to work in broadcasting?"
Yeah, and you said that, you know, you'd initially sort of said no. So in a way, you know, you sort of hinted towards it. But what changed, and in more specifically, why did commentating appeal then, from it having been a no to go on then?
Well, I think the initial appeal was that it kept me very much directly involved in the thing I was just giving up, which is always hard and difficult. By being a commentator, Tim and I were going to the meets. We were hanging around with the athletes in the athletes' hotel because I was chatting, and and they saw us. Both Tim and I were, Tim was retired 2-3 years before me, so we're recently retired. We knew everybody, so. Yeah. We were being given stuff they probably wouldn't normally give, and actually, I quite enjoyed that. So there was that element. I was maintaining. I wasn't having to make difficult choices about giving up that what had been a massive part of my life. I just shifted into a slightly different mode. But the other aspect of it was, I realized that certainly in those days, I was getting nervous, and particularly distance races, and I was, it's what I loved, and there's a. You realize that commentary in sport, you go with the flow of what's happening. It's kind of, and I realized, the 100 meters, I talked faster, and because you have to, because you got to get, and then the 1500s, and I love the tactics. And I was really enjoying being part of the event as it happened, rather than talking about it afterwards and trying to analyze it, if that's
okay.
I don't mind the analyzing. I enjoy that as well, but actually analyzing while it's happening, particularly distance races, and the difficult thing in the early days was, and again, lots of help from experienced people from Coleman downwards, was not to keep referring to my career and what I would have done and what I, I tried really hard. I'm not saying that I always managed to pull it off. But particularly in those early days, that was the most difficult thing, not to keep referring to, this is what I did. This is what I would have done.
Yeah.
this is what I, this is my experience. So therefore his or hers should be the same. So
And how did you find then the sort of, as you were trying to find your own style, and you've got someone of the behemoth of broadcasting legend like David Coleman, over your shoulder. He retired in 2000, so there was obviously a bit of crossover while you were in the commentary box, whether it was at Eurosport or once you'd started with the BBC. So, what did you think of yourself in those early years? How easy was it to find your voice?
Well, it was more tricky when I moved to the BBC, not to find my voice, as it were. It was that there was a hierarchy there, and there was a lot of people who'd been doing what they were doing very well for a very long time, and this young upstart, despite the fact I knew all of them and was on knew them all very, very well, Tim and I. That was just us, kind of going with the flow sort of thing. And whereas this was different. And
a bit more shirt and tie?
It wasn't quite shirt and tie, but it was, remember I said to you, Tim came in with the coffees that, there's no drinks allowed. There's no this, there's no that. There's no, it's lip mics. And they had a discipline that they'd been working to for a long, long time. And I found some of it, I almost said juvenile. Having had a lot of independence to begin with, I then moved into a slightly more regimented environment, and I found that a bit restrictive. And so I'll give an example. In the summer of 1999, so that was my first World Championships commentator for the BBC, and there was still Coleman and Stuart Story and Paul Dickinson and Brendan, and the team was quite large. And I found that their way of operating with the commentators was they would let you know. I'd get a sheet under my door kind of the night before a big final or whatever, and suddenly go, I'd get the allocations. You'd get the allocations either the night before or the morning of. Now, I realized I didn't know why.
And what would those allocations be?
Well, that's about which races you're going to commentate. Yeah, which because there was at that point there was still Coleman and me and Stuart, and so who's going to be the lead commentator on which races? Yeah, and I asked, I said, why so late? Why can't we be told a bit more in advance? Because otherwise I'm prepping some races that I'm not going to commentate on, and other races if I know I'm doing it, I can do more homework. And the comment came back because they always row about who's doing what, so it's better to not tell them until the last minute. And I'm thinking,
wow.
Well, that's what broadcasting, there's a lot of that in broadcast. There's egos and there's, you know, there's competition. It's competitive. And I don't think I'd understood that. But I have seen it a lot. And Tim and I didn't have it in our early years at all. But as we've both grown, and occasionally we go back together and work together, and we still sometimes, when we're doing the Diamond Leagues these days, we still sometimes have a bit that we try and look at the season as a whole and kind of go, but, you know, there are certain meets where you go, I really want to do the men's 100 tonight. You know, I want to be the lead on that. And Tim's like, oh, well, you did it last week. You know, so there's always but we always come to an agreement. But that one was, and I like to think that I changed some things quite early that I just felt were, but that was difficult to do. I found that difficult to speak up in that environment where you had all of these people who'd been doing it for a long, long time. And indeed defending or asking for some things that were new, you know, and to start to say, look, why can't we do that? And what have you thought about that? And sometimes you'd get a raised eyebrow and, you know, kind of.
Yeah. But what were some of the hardest battles you had to fight?
I don't think I ever fought anything. I think it was about, it was partly about that idea that, you know, we could cover events a little bit differently. And also that, you're having enough time to kind of, and it's probably gone a little bit in the wrong direction. And I've been doing it so long now, it's hard to remember some stuff. But you know, you need to build up, and even for a commentator, you know, you need a little bit of time to get to build up into an event. You're the one who's going to commentate it. And, you know, particularly big championships and things, we've got studios and we've got studio guests and all the rest of it, and they've got things they want to say. But if they hand to you at a point where, because, you know, particularly let's say it's a distance race, for instance, you know, and I want to make a point about, because I know in the race X or Y might happen, and you want to highlight it beforehand or at least set it up. If he does that, he might do that. If she does this, she's going to have to do that, you know. And so I was, you know, trying to, and athletics is so difficult because, you know, we're jumping from one thing to the next, and we're trying to make it look good for the viewer. You're trying to give some of that background information, and you're trying to cover the thing live as it happens, and you don't know what's going to happen. Of course you don't. And you're going to go live to the long jump, and then the guy knows jumps, and you're like, oh, that was a waste of time. And that happens. So you've got to, and that's why, you know, we have good editors and people making those decisions. So the hardest thing was, and I've just realized what it was now, we weren't being asked, commentators, and I'm not sure that, I think it was because of Force Habit. In the Channel 4 thing, I went to the production meetings with it was a small team, and I was part of the production team as the lead commentator, and have these discussions and say, you know, we really need to watch, we need that race there is going to be, and we need to, and we'd have those discussions in the week leading up to the event,
you're then able to, as you discussed before, whether it's, you know, biogs on screen or different things, you've got a team that know where you might be wanting to go with a particular story.
So when I turned up the BBC and I asked when the production meeting was, they just laughed at me. And I literally was told, what on earth do you want to come to a production meeting for? Not because they didn't want me to be there, but that the other guys who for years had been there for, you know, I don't know how many years, had obviously decided, production meetings, you know, I don't need to be at that. Whereas I felt as though I wanted to and wanted to be more part of that. So that was one of the...
That's really interesting.
...changes, if you like, that it was about, look, I want to be more involved. I at least want to understand. It goes back to that very first night at Eurosport. If something bad's coming down the tunnel, I prefer to know before, you know, that it's coming down the tunnel. Before it hits me. So, and actually being part of a production meeting, so you at least go into a program knowing this is what we're trying to do, this is where we're going, this is where it's heading and all the rest of it, rather than just turn up and you go, oh, there's the running order, oh, I didn't know we were going to do that sort of thing. So the world's very different now, you know, and the world of broadcasting is very different, but back then there were big teams and people had set roles and didn't necessarily cut across each other.
And I guess there's got to be that slight sense. I mean, you can tell me, but you know, you've been top of your game in an athletics field. You've won multiple titles. You've done your interviews. You've been top dog. And then, although you know your going into a new environment and you're going to have to acknowledge that you're not top dog, it must still be difficult if you've got ideas on how to progress things and improve things on your terms that maybe aren't being received terribly well.
Possibly, yes. I think it was more because, going back to that those early experiences, you realize that as a commentator, you're the last bit of a big puzzle that's being pulled together, you know, kind of a live puzzle, if you like, with all these different component parts, from the cameraman to the sound man to the director, your program editor, your co-commentator. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that each bit of it, if it falls down, the whole thing falls down. So you're all in it together. And I wanted to know more. You know, I wanted to understand a little bit more about why is the guy in my ear saying, shut up, we're going to, you know, whatever. I want to know why that's happening. I want to know. Yeah. I want to understand. I mean, it sounds a bit...
Is that you as a person in life generally?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm very happy to ignore all sorts of things I don't need to know. It frustrates the hell out of Alison. She'll go, oh, la, la, la. I don't do social media and that sort of stuff. So Alison will go, all right. And I go, And she go, are you not interested? I go, no, actually, because tomorrow it won't be part of my life, or next year, or 5 years from now. But other things I get into in such a way, particularly if it's something I'm going to be, and I want to, you know, we have an events company and our team gets so frustrated. I will be putting the bins out. You know, I try to do every bit of our event delivery and understand. And yes, sometimes end up my head exploding because I hope I'm reasonable at delegating, but I do want to know what everybody's job is and what they're doing and how they should be doing that. So that it all comes together. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think,
no, well, that makes sense.
Yeah. So even on Eurosport, I remember once we were on air at the European Indoor Champs, and I was getting, I talked about return feed and satellites, and we were using phone lines for commentary, and the guy in the studio, some young person back in Paris, we worked through the Paris studios, and I get beamed down around Europe, kept telling us to not to commentate off the live action and to commentate off the picture. And I said, there's a delay, you know, I'll getting Tim to ring his wife. We had mobile phones, we're all new, while we're live on air. And I was doing some queuing things, you know, saying a certain word, a certain thing was happening, for her to tell us that it was synced. And I then was back on the talk back to Paris, go, you are wrong. We're going to commentate off the, you know, so it's.
Wow. So you're actually checking the satellite feed. And
but that's, how should I put it? That's, it helps, you know. I think it does help. I think it does help.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know the full system. I'm going to sort of bring you back to a question that I think you were going towards, and then you know, fascinating to get the other bits and pieces. How do you think you sounded when you first started?
My voice has changed, so it was. I realised that you know, as I got more excited, I was you inevitably a bit more high pitched. I didn't really think about how my voice sounded. I figured that you come out of an objective world where you come first, second, third, and you know where you are, right? There's the result, and I need to get better and whatever. And one of my early experiences, again, and this was more BBC, I was getting more and doing more, so more people were hearing me. I was on the BBC. And thankfully, we didn't have social media, so I wasn't reading if everyone was going, oh, he's crap him or, you know, whatever. So I was waiting for that, you know, right. And I'd had lots of good tips from Coleman and others. But I realized at the end of every program, you know, they were coming, hey, brilliant, well done, mate. It was all good. Yeah, well done. You know, it was brilliant. Oh, you're great. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'd had one program and... it was in Manchester again. It's funny how you remember these things. And we're standing at the scanners and this, yeah, you were great. And I knew I hadn't been. Or I thought I hadn't been.
Yeah.
And I stopped this individual and I said, look, that's all very nice of you, but I respect you. You've been doing this for a long, long, long time.
Mm.
And if I'm going to get better at this, I need you to stop telling me every time I come off air, you're brilliant. And he said, oh, well, you know, we like to keep everyone's confidence high. I goes, I understand that, but I've come from a world where, you know, we get better by learning from what we're not doing right. And I said, I am not going to collapse my ego. You know, I have a level of confidence that I'm not, and it is true, mind you, broadcasting, if you lose your confidence, it can be tricky, but
it's also his, you know, we've heard it from lots of our guests on the series, and I'm sat in front of my laptop here, and as you started speaking then I double clicked on the word feedback right in front of me because I knew exactly where you were going with it. And also it becomes ever more relevant, I think, to ex-athletes, because they've come from an environment where, as you say, you're being given feedback, you're being told where to improve, you know that you're not the finished article, because if you were, you know, the world would end, and so you're constantly able to pick things up or be reminded or told things that you could improve on. And coming from an athletics background, you were clearly used to that. And so actually none of that, having realized that this is a path that you're going up. Mm. Yeah. Unsurprisingly is something that you wanted to get more of.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's only so much, but what you realize as well is that in athletics, or in an objective world, if you do come first, there's no argument. You know, that's it. Mm. You can't. Oh, I thought you were second. No, you were first. The trouble is, you can do something very well, and somebody's still not going to like it. You know, people watch the news. I mean, I've done it myself. You sit and watch the news and go, look at that bloody tie he's wearing tonight. You know, and he's talking about some terrorist thing. And you know, that's how we absorb the media in different ways, and we all you asked about a voice, you will like somebody's voice much better than you like somebody else's. I think what I had to learn was, particularly at championships, you know, we do a lot of hours, morning sessions, evening sessions, sometimes four or five, we sometimes can be commentating for 10 hours a day, at a major championships, not constantly commentating, but you're in a stadium.
You're in and out.
You're in a stadium with 60, 70, 80, 90,000 people. It's loud. You know, you're fighting the PA, you're the atmosphere. So you have to, in the same way that I've never done any voice training, but I've had to learn to coax my voice through 10 days of an Olympic athletics program or whatever it might be.
Well, someone like Bob Ballard would tell us that if he's doing an Olympics and several days events in the pool, while someone wants to go out for a couple of beers after night number one, he would be safely tucked up because he knows his voice is his instrument that's got to last.
Yeah, you got to pace yourself. So I think there are lots of things I've learned to do with the sort of technique of using your voice, as it were. But I've never worried about. I've never got too stressed about. You know, what do I sound how I sound, you know, and it has changed. I know it's changed, and all of our voices change over a period of time. I could never sing, thank goodness, but I think one of the things that has happened is that I know, just in my general daily voice, I've actually probably strained enough that if I was asked to try and do a soprano impersonation, I'm not sure I ever could, but you know what I mean. So I think
we won't be rushing into that.
No. You've obviously never heard me sing. It's probably a good job. So I think all of those things you talked about right at the very beginning about training and things. And, you know, there are techniques to all of this, and some of the things I picked up by just doing it. A lot of things just by doing it, and you develop your own way and you develop your own style. There were some great tips early on. Just Coleman once said to me, he said lots to me, in both just before I started commentary, when I started, and then particularly when I joined the BBC, and things like, don't guess if you don't know. We have a lot of, a thousandth of a second difference. It's not my job to tell you who's won. It sort of is, but if I don't know, I don't know. You know, if it's that close. Now, watching athletics for 1,000 years, you get a bit of a feeling for, you know, who's just in front of who, and you've got to go with the excitement of, you know, he did it, she did it, or maybe did he not? You know, so I had to learn a little bit of, because there's nothing wrong with a little bit of, wow, what happened? You know, kind of
Yeah.
What is the result? Because there's nothing wrong with that either. Because I used to think, oh, my job is to go, he won, she was second. You know, and it's not actually. And I used to pride myself, 100-meter race, I'm going first, second, third, fourth, you know, like a snapshot straight away and telling you what it was. Well, the result's going to come up. I mean, the results didn't come up quite as quick in those days, but it's going to be up there in 10 seconds. Anyway, so I worry less about that these days than I used to. I'm more interested in you know, the reaction to what's happened and following that through rather than necessarily being, I mean, obviously if someone's close to a world record, you quickly look at the time and all the rest of it. But so it's actually more about that than, I think in the early days I was, who's first, who's second, who's third sort of thing. Yeah. That is important. It's incredibly important, but you shouldn't let that detract from, so I would stress about, oh, I don't know, I think it's him. I mean, there was a very good example. I got to the point, I had some really close finishes early on in my career, but one of them a little bit later was Kelly Holmes when she won the Olympics by 2,000 of a second. That was when I kind of lost my little bit of, because Kelly didn't know, and by then I did know. I sort of called it as she crossed the line anyway that she'd won.
Yeah.
And then it comes up on your computer, on your CIS, before it comes up on the screen in the stadium. And I'm shouting like an idiot. I mean, she's 40 yards down on the track. She can't hear me. And I'm shouting, you've won it, Kelly, you've won it. You know, that was one of the times I forgot. I was so wrapped up in that moment. But that also gives you some
In a way, that, you know, those of us that are an audience hearing it, that's almost what we as viewers are screaming at our TVs, isn't it? So in a way, there are definitely, and that's come up a few times, there are those moments when a commentator says the sort of thing that you're thinking, and it's validation for sharing the moment, I guess.
It is. And, again, BBC, we're very good at teaching me not to get too jingoistic and all the rest of it. You know, that's important. You know, we're commentating on a world sport and great athletes from around the world. And it's not the Brits v. the rest. But our audience is you sitting at home in Hexham in Northumberland or in Cornwall or whatever, you know, so we are, you do a fair commentary that isn't too good, but when something good happens, goodness me, let yourself go. That's how I used to feel. There's nothing wrong with that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And talking then of the sort of discipline of it, I mean, certainly the track events more so than the field bits, but speaking to John Hunt, obviously on the racing, and he does bits of swimming as well, and Mike Costello, there's what I call this linear element to it. You know, there's a start and an end point. And these things will vary in length. Obviously, doing 100 meters with Usain Bolt is going to be very different to calling a 10,000 meter race, and also one that the cameras are going to come to and from in that sense. So just tell me a bit about how you kind of approach those, knowing that you've got to get the tone right. There's either a long way to go, or you're only really going to be saying two sentences or three sentences over the course of about 9 seconds.
Yeah. Well, if you took, there was a girl from Madagascar called Ramalala Narina, who was very good 60-meter hurdler run in the 90s and into the 2000s. So I was commenting on her a fair bit. And on the indoor season, that race takes like 7 seconds. Yeah.
I can see where this is going.
And she would often, and if you say Ramalala Narina once, that's half your commentary gone, right? Coleman used to refer to her as the little Madagascan for a long time, but yes, that was another thing I learned from Coleman. You know, if you couldn't remember the name or you weren't sure, just there's nothing wrong with their nationality. You know, like, okay,
yeah.
So yes, you know, you've got to be. So what do you do in 100 meters? So again, this was a tip from Coleman. At the start. Yeah. So what are you looking for? What are you looking for at the start? You know, how do you get your brain? So it's a bit like the athlete, you know, it's on your marks, set. So I like to shut up and be poised, if you like.
And almost actually, just to take you a bit of a step before that, there'll be a moment sometimes when you're being handed to for that crown jewel moment, that event.
Yes.
And so actually it's from the athletes being presented to the crowd and that sort of thing. So actually in the same way that I would on a rugby match, I'd have a couple of lines written in just to sort of ease me into that moment. I saw something that I think you'd said a number of years ago where you said, you know, don't write anything. You know, I might look at the stats, but don't write too much. And I know that a lot of us in other sports like that being the settler and a couple of sentences to set the scene and where we're at and what's about to happen. And then away we go. Is that something that you will do for an event like that?
I like to some extent, yeah. So we normally get 8 seconds of intro on each athlete on a lane by lane, if we're doing lane by lanes.
Right.
It used to be 10, sort of 8 now. You can't say a lot in 8 seconds. So yes, I mean, I've got a stat sheet for each race, you know, if I need it. And because you've already prepped it, I've probably got a line or two in my head. I don't think I ever really write a line on each person, because you can either... So if it's someone who's not that well known, for instance, they're in lane one, that's when you can kind of go, French champion, you know, he ran a personal best in semifinals to make it into the final, you know, his first ever world championship final. I don't sort of need to have that written down, but you get into the middle lanes and you're going to go, well, there he is, Usain Bolt, you know, he looks relaxed. You know, that to me is more about what am I seeing in front of me? Even in those, but you're right, it is me. So what that does is it gives me the geography of the race, the 8 lanes, who's in 1, who's in 2, who's in 3, who's in 4, who's in 5, who's in 6. He's wearing this, he's wearing that. You know, when championships are great because all wearing the national colours. Diamond League.
It's as much for you as it is the audience.
It's as much for us. Diamond League, sometimes a bit more tricky. So, but it is, it's just making sure, particularly things like hurdles, like who's in lane 4 and who's in lane 5, who's in lane 6. Right. And Coleman's tip was, so then you get this pause. And this is all about camera angles as well. We've usually had a few close-ups going into the blocks, whatever. And then just before the race, they'll come out to a wide shot. And that's often where I'll just go, right, the men's 100-meter final.
Yeah.
Pause. So the gun goes, and Coleman used to always go, don't forget, Crummy, there's always someone gets a good start or a bad start. I went, all right. He goes, so pick who that is. I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, so this was a trick of, it's not a trick. I don't use it all the time, but it can be good. So let's say in lane 3, Jimmy Vicot of France is in lane 3, all right? And when I know that a lot of the time Jimmy gets a good start, right? You might have Colin Jackson, and you know that 9 times out of 10, Colin gets a good start. So for my commentary, to give me the 2 seconds to see what's actually happening, although I haven't written it down or anything, you might go, good start from Colin Jackson, or...
Yeah.
Bad start from Colin Jackson, you know, poor start. Now, I wouldn't say use that all the time, but I'll promise you, most athletic commentators, if you watch 100 meters or 60 meter race, whatever, they're gonna give themselves a line or two, usually which is about the start. And the amount of times you'd be surprised, I've had athletes come up to me later, goes, you said I had a good start. I had a crap start. I go, I wasn't really looking.
Well, because then once you've done it, once you've got a half, once
they're 10 yards into it, you can actually see who's had a good start and who's had a bad start or whatever. So, because actually your eyes, it's really hard to watch eight people simultaneously rise. It's easy in slow-mo, but so there's a technique to that. And then you go with a race and then, you know, and you're right. You've got to be careful not to gabble in a 100 or a 60 meter race. Sometimes there's nothing wrong with Met saying Usain Bolt's name. It's almost the Ruby. You know, you kind of if you haven't got time to, because what you don't want to do is be trying to say too much in the race and you get the finish line and you haven't caught up. So yeah, sprint races are tricky in that sense. So each race has some, I guess, its own geography and therefore its own language. And what I mean by that is, you know, in the hurdles, we'll talk about stride patterns. We'll talk about, you know, stuttering. We'll talk about, you know, there's a vocabulary which I'll use in that race, which I'm not going to use there's a vocabulary in the 400 I'm not going to use in the 100. There's definitely a vocabulary in the 5000 that I'm not going to use in the 1500. So you kind of bring all these tools in your head and you're right. The race follows, your commentary kind of follows the pacing of a 1500 meter race, the pacing of a 10,000 meter race, the pacing of a marathon. And yes, in the 10,000 meter race, we might pop off to do a bit of discus and a bit of this and a bit of that, which actually gives me the chance just to, right, check the lap times. I think I said, because I'm, this is all important, relevant information. So I don't know.
How often would you, I'm asking now out of just a moment of not really thinking properly, but off the top of my head, how often would you be doing something like a 10,000 where you're leading on that? Would you then have to be a commentator on another field event yourself?
Yeah, in the Diamond Leagues when there's just Tim and I, we do that all the time. Yeah, or if the Beeb occasionally we'll take a meet like that. I mean, normally...
and you're relying on a director or a producer at that stage to go, okay,
which
is the defending champion in the discus and it's his second effort, or
you are relying on that, but it doesn't always happen. In fact, on the Diamond League, it often doesn't happen. So that's producing the world feed. The people who are listening to this will understand that. And often the host broadcaster sort of ignores the world feed. And so for instance, if the BBC are putting it out live on BBC One, and I've begged them to make sure we put good people on the world feed because I know the job that those commentators have. So when we're going back to the studio for Gabby and the guys, the competition is still going on the world feed. They're not seeing that. So somebody is going to them. Yeah, it's the third round of the discus. It's X and it's Y. You will. That's why we need to be in the stadium, because most of the time, a lot of the time, we have people working on athletics. It's a tough sport to direct, to edit. And if you haven't got good experience, people that can get themselves in a right mess. So when to go live to a field event and when to put in recorded field is so important. So when Tim and I are at an event, we're commentating all the track, and the two of us will work on every race. One's leading, one's co-commentating. You're doing results, you're doing whatever. You're also watching the discus happening there, because you heard a bit of a roar just before that 100 meter went, what the hell was that about, and the long jump on the back straight and then the pole vaults up at the top bend. You've got to be across all of that. You've got your CIS. It is, you come off air of a Diamond League, 2-hour Diamond League, with your head just going wah, and if you're not getting good cue around what's coming, and again, these are just tricks that you learn. Christian Taylor pops up on my screen, and I haven't heard anything. And I go, it's obviously Christian Taylor. It's a triple jump. I look down. There's no Christian Taylor down there. So that tells me straight away it's off.
This is a replay.
It's off tape. I haven't seen Christian for half an hour. All right. The competition's in round three, but in round two, he jumped 1784. This could be that jump. All right, but it might not be, because funny enough, the trouble is you start to go, this will be that jump, because a clever editor will catch up. And then he goes running down the runway and it's a no jump. And you go, oh, this was actually his, So you just have to be on your toes. But
yeah.
It's good fun.
Yeah, I bet. we talked a little bit about the scripting. And another side of it is sort of working with co-commentators. Mm-hmm. It's something that there's perhaps a little less of that we hear in athletics, I think, because more often than not, by the time you've called the big race, it's going back to a studio maybe for reaction. It doesn't seem to be something that you hear a whole lot of former athletes alongside you necessarily.
Yeah, except in the distance races. So yeah, I worked with Brendan for a long time, and then more recently with Paula.
And the great Brendan Foster, who
yeah, well, the Bren, I've been working with Bren and different guys since I was about 14. But he was an incredibly important person in my life, both athletically and broadcasting wise. And in the later years, he had a relationship with Coleman, and then we developed our own relationship, which was great, and a way of working. And you have to have you've got to know each other well. You don't want to interrupt. You don't want to, but you want to have some. You want to have a relationship on air that a way of working commentary wise that complements, And so when I'm doing a distance race with Bren, 5,000, 10,000, what? I think in Bren's later career, he'd done so much broadcasting, you could sometimes lapse into, he's first, he's second, he's third, whatever, which was actually, we work best when, I'm giving you the geography of the race and whatever, and then Bren's coming in, he needs to move up now, this needs to happen, the pace is a bit slower. But actually, we both do both of those things because we're both athletes, but it worked really well. And we had a lot of good banter. And then with Paula...
My favourite with Brendan Foster was just his fabulous northeast tones, much like your own, on various names like Bullmerger, and people like that.
We used to get in taxis, often going to Crystal Palace or something. We'd be in a car, and the driver would go on, lads, just say Rosa Mota or Wilson Kipketer, well, that was the thing.
If I
commentate with Bren, I inevitably felt my Geordie accent came out a little bit more strongly. But yes, Paula's a bit more posh. So that's where those the co-commentary really is important, particularly things like marathon, 10,000, 5,000. And it's important that's a double act. And it's a good double act that works. You try and, as I said, that you're not both saying the same things. The danger sometimes is for Tim and I when we are doing things like Diamond Leagues, and there's so much happening. When your co-commentator is talking, you have a tendency to be looking, as I said before, right? What's going on in the discus? What's going on in the javelin? Because you were talking before, and you're trying to catch up, and you're also trying to listen to him. And the amount of times I've had him go, so what did you think about that, Steve? He said something, or I'll come back. He stopped talking, and I'll stop talking, and he'll go, I just said that sort of thing. But Tim and I have a great relationship as well. We've been working together for so many years, so I really enjoy that. And I think you're right, though, that the shorter races, commentators need their. we've got things that we're trying to describe the action, and you're trying to hopefully inform people as well. And having a rhythm to that's important. Yeah. So too many interruptions to that makes it, it's not so easy to get a bit staccato. But we are, as I said, we're making a television program, and the studio and the studio guests and the commentary and the interviews, and it's all part of that program. So you've got to accept that. Yes, I love doing Diamond Leagues where there's just me and Tim, no presenters, bang, 2 hours of athletics. That's a purest form of it.
And it's interesting actually hearing you talk about those and clearly how regularly you must work on things like that compared to perhaps how often the public at large are hearing you when it's more likely to be at the bigger Commonwealth Games or World Championships.
Yeah, you'd have to be, obviously the Diamond Leagues, BBC have all the highlights to them. But you've got to be an athletics fan probably. So if you're watching it live though on Eurosport, the live rights to it in the UK, we've been doing Diamond League for 10 years now. And they're up to 14 meets a year, 14, 15 meets a year around the world, Shanghai and Eugene and Rome, around Europe, the whole thing. But that actually is what helps me when I come to do the domestic meets or to do the championships and all the rest of it, because I'm working on it all the time.
Because you've seen it, yeah. Are you always in stadia, or is any of it off tube?
Occasionally off tube if we've got any problem. Athletics is so... I did plenty of off tube at Eurosport, and we have to do off tube occasionally. And these days, the way things are going, that might be more happen more regularly. But athletics, for the reasons I've just said to you, if you're sitting in an off tube in Salford, you know, we have to do the European Cross Country Championships, and you know, as has happened, you know, we you're trying to work out team positions and all the rest of it, and who's in seventh place, and if the cameras are only following the guy in the front, whereas if I'm at the event, they're going to come past in front of me, and I can and then in an athletic stadium, same thing. There are things happening all around the stadium that you sort of need to be able to see. And the other thing as well, and this really depends on what people want from commentary, you know, particularly on the Diamond League, we are part of the setup. So we're commentating for the World Feed. So we stay in the athlete's hotel. So I'm spending my night, the night before, I'm in the bar, not drinking necessarily, but I am talking to X's manager or so-and-so's coach or even the athlete themselves, which is really going to inform the commentary the next day. You don't get that doing it off tube.
You can, certainly.
You know, you can text people, but it's not the same.
Absolutely.
You bump into athletes in the restaurant. You know, that they were never going to offer this to you, but then you find out they've had a bit of a niggle, and being at an event is I think anyway for athletics is really really important. We do some off tube, but generally speaking, we're there. So that's why I'm never home in the summer.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you could just live and breathe it more, can't you? You pick up the nuances of, and atmospheres around things, which you can bring across in a way that people, you know, they can't pick up on that when they're just watching TV. So if you've got that extra level from being there, it helps to bring that to people. I'm conscious of time, Steve, and I could you know chat forever. I've just got a few more if I may. There are obviously moments like Super Saturday 2012, particularly for those of us that remember that from a British point of view. You can get to being the top of your game as an athlete, and the opportunity to then be on form on a night like that and take the responsibility of bringing that to a nation and an international audience. Do you, obviously, you know, as we've discussed, you can't predict how things are going to happen, but obviously knowing certain athletes, knowing certain events are coming up, a run of events on any particular day during a championship, will you wake up that morning and have the adrenaline? Will you be nervous? Will you be excited? Will you feel the sense of responsibility that the nation are wanting you to hit the right moments?
Hopefully I don't feel the last one too much. No, I do get excited. I think a bit like through my athletics career, at the beginning you get nervous for everything, you know, and then gradually, you know, the nerves, you get control of them, and then you get really nervous for the big things. And I'm probably like that now, you know. There are events I really look forward to. And you're right, at the Olympics, there are certain things. And that's why it's important to know a little bit in advance, as we do now. You know, I get the opportunity to say, you know, I want to do that race and I want to do it. And we share it around, but, you know, I can kind of go, I really would like to do that. And I get excited about that. You know, I think, and it isn't just about your British people winning medals. Super Saturday was very much about that. We were in London, for goodness sake. But sometimes, you know, one of the lines that Coleman said to me towards, in fact, I think he was already retired. I think it was at a lunch somewhere that I was having with him and Bren. Yeah, it was. And I was being pushed into presenting quite a bit. And that was seen as something I should, the presenting somehow is the, that's what you really want to do. You know, it's okay being a commentator, but presenting is where it's really at. And
yeah, you can keep me behind a microphone, but yeah, carry on.
Yeah. And, you know, so, and I was doing a fair bit and I was enjoying aspects of it, and come back to what you were saying. I was getting nervous for the wrong reasons then. That then is about, you know, and I realized it was very different. I was talking to Coleman about it and I said, they were wanting me, and Roger Black had just left, and that we'd experimented with me presenting the program, opening the program on air. Da, 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 here we are at, you know, Gateshead Stadium. Da, 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 here's my guest. Set it all up, Jim. And then I ran into the commentary box and did 2-3 races, and then came back down, did a bit more presenting. And at the end of it, I thought, I'm doing both jobs crap here. You know, right, I'm doing both, and I'm nervous for the wrong reasons and everything. And I was telling Coleman this, and he said, right, he says, just remember this, and this is not to, and he's probably not 100% right, but he sort of is, and it's not to knock anyone. Or he said, Cramie, he goes, just remember, if you need to choose between one and the other, and ego isn't part of what you're about, which I don't think it is, he said, nobody ever replays a great piece of presenting.
It's true.
And he challenged me. He said, go on, you show me how often they show you. He goes, when you do a great piece of commentary, it's linked to a great piece of sport, which will get replayed over and over. And actually, sometimes even if your commentary isn't great, it's the context of it his point was, that's happening, and you come to your thing about getting excited and get nervous. So Super Saturday will live with people forever for their whole lives as a memory. Yeah. It lives for me as a memory, but I also know that when people replay Super Saturday, in a small way, we're only the wallpaper of the backdrop of, but you are a part of that. And I'm always internally grateful to Coleman for that sort of line, because I mean, there have been some great bits of presenting that occasionally pop up, but if you know what I mean, but the thing that people will remember,
bloopers, to be fair, but
they are, the thing that the athletes remember, the public will remember is those incredible moments that sport gives you. And you want to be part of that. You want to be part of that when it happens, right or wrong, whether you do great commentary or not so good commentary, or, it doesn't matter. You are part of it while it happens. And it really helped me from that point forward to kind of go, that's what I do. I'm happy to do the odd bit of presenting when if it crops up, whatever. But this is what I want to do, and this is what I like doing.
Yeah, and talking of if things don't quite go as one planned, how do you cope with that? Do you still have moments now where you will put the mic down and think that wasn't the greatest, today, or I'm not happy with that?
And loads of times.
if you make a mistake during a particular commentary, how do you deal with it? How does it make you feel? Can you move past it?
Forget it. I think having had a career as a sports person, you learn how to deal with, you have to always move on. You learn, if you can. I mean, if it's just, I got a fact wrong, and that actually is the thing that narks me more than anything else. And that's not necessarily because I didn't know it. I'll just either missay it or, I'm getting old as well. We have a lot of statistics in athletics. Personal best, season's best, the competition, what you're doing, it's numbers, and it can, you make the odd mistake, of course you do. Are you sitting at home going to realize? Probably not, unless I tell you. But I know that somewhere somebody's coach or athlete has gone, can't believe you said that, So I try to be factually correct, and if I'm wrong, I get a little bit annoyed for a bit, and then I realize that's part positive. If I do something which, if I just perform badly, again, I will. I want to make sure that doesn't happen again. So if there's something that I did wrong, I'll make sure that But I don't let it bother me. I don't let it. It happens. I've certainly been doing it for too long. But remember going back to that early Eurosport story I was telling you. You have to learn, and I think that's why sports career helps you so much with this. And come back, the guy who said, telling you every time you're brilliant. You're not brilliant all the time. If you're ever brilliant, that you're lucky. But you've just got to be able to accept that when you make a mistake, it's probably reasonably high profile. I.e., people are, there's could be millions of people hearing you say something wrong. It's less to do with that. It's more that I haven't performed at a level at which I'd be happy with. And that's the athlete in me. So that's when I want to kind of go, no, come on. It could be, for instance, you're talking about Bob Ballard, am I getting enough sleep? Or was I too tired? I was like, I didn't prep that race properly. I just turned up and, so every now and then you give yourself a little kick up the backside. Say, come on.
Little wake up that you've been a bit casual.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Who've been the sporting voices that you've rated over the years, and who out there do you think now is doing good work?
Oh, that's hard, isn't it? I mean, I was, I guess, the, The thing was, back then, there was so much live sport, there seemed to be, but with two, three channels. So, you know, people like Bill McLaren and Murray Walker and obviously Coleman Peter O'Sullivan in horse racing.
Yeah.
You know, these guys were on your screens every Saturday and during the week, you know, or seemed as though they were. And so they were... And I think you absorb some of that without... I mean, there's definitely some things of Coleman that I've absorbed because I heard him commentate a lot. There's a guy in athletics who I really respected called Bruce McAvenny, who's an Australian. And Bruce, if he was sitting here with me now, he'd know more about my career than... He's a bit older these days. But people like Bruce taught me that... a bit like any performer, the more preparation you've done, the easier it is to be yourself. You talked about that, didn't you? If you're spending too much of your time thinking, oh, what was it? You know, like you're not, and that's the problem with athletics. So I'm working on athletics all the time. I've got quite good short-term memory.
Good.
And I can absorb information and kind of have it there for when I need it. A week later, I might have forgotten it, but you know, for when I need it. So that when you go on air, and Bruce was, he sort of taught me that as well. And then there are others who I think, you're saying, who do I, it's really hard these days to say who are.
It's the nature of the fragmented landscape, isn't it?
I was just going to say, there must be 100 football commentators I listen to. You feel as though there are, aren't there? There's lots. I think people like John Hunt I enjoy watching horse racing. There are aspects of I love watching cricket, and sadly a lot of the sort of cricket folks are starting to. I mean, I've gone back to the great names, people like Richie Beno and what have you, but yeah. I think there are lots of people who've. I listen to a fair bit of radio, sport on the radio as well, I guess. So, you know, he's sort of often driving, travelling a fair bit.
From near up your way is John Murray, who we've spoken to.
I think I'd love to do a little bit more radio. It's a different type of commentary. You're talking about Mike Costello doing athletics commentary. You know, athletics on the radio is not easy. I've done a little bit of it. I don't know. It's a bit difficult to. Names will come to mind after I've finished this.
That's all right.
And go, oh, well, it should have been X and Y, but yes.
No, it's fine. I mean, yeah, some of the names you've mentioned are great. And you've almost prefaced my penultimate question. What might you have liked to have the chance to commentate on that you've not had the chance to?
I still hanker a little bit to do football commentary.
Do you?
I nearly did. I'm not going to go into it, but after 2012, I was asked to shift away. And I said no.
Wow. What made you say no then?
Just my lifestyle. You know, athletics has a fairly structure to it, and I understand that. The idea of doing lots and lots of football matches. I love my football, and if I'm a hero,
would it have had to have been an all or nothing in terms of football and athletics? Or do you think would your headspace have needed it to in terms of making that decision?
It would have been difficult to do both, I think. But football is a because Alison gets very annoyed at me. I'd sit at home watching things, and she'll say, "Will you shut up?" I find myself kind of, you know, almost commentating things. I would have loved. I mean, the only other sport I do a lot of commentary on is curling, of course, which is so different.
I'm conscious that we haven't touched on that, which you've done for the Winter Olympics.
I love the curling. You know, 3 hours where you just sit, which I liken a little bit to sort of test match special. You know,
is it 3 hours?
A game can last, that's what we get a slot. They'll normally last somewhere between two and it can go as long as 3 hours if you have an extra end or a couple of extra ends.
Gosh.
It can be all over. The thing about curling can be all over an hour and a half. You can get five ends and maybe six ends.
I hope you're not being paid per match then.
I wish I had at the Olympics. God, we did. Do you know how many matches? I did 34. four matches these Olympics. Anyway, I won't bore you with it.
Wow.
Because we had mixed curling, and then we have the round robins, and then we have the quarterfinal, semi-final. So I was three sessions a day. Morning match.
Just to touch on this, while we're talking about it then, how quickly does it allow you to... Because I'm guessing at some point someone said, do you fancy having a go at?
Yes, that's what happened.
And then you go, sure. And I mean, maybe it hasn't even happened and you're just, you know, able to apply your skills to it. But how long does it take to sort of dedicate the homework and commentary ability in one sense to it then actually becoming something that you feel you know and like and enjoy?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't pick an easy one.
That may not have happened, I appreciate.
No, I know. So let's say I turned up to do a football match tomorrow without any prep. I'd have the language, I'd have the vocabulary, I'd know what was going on. You know, I've watched enough football over there. So I wouldn't feel... When I first started with curling, I was so... the only reason I said yes was because I'd been presenting from the curling at the... We'd a little bit 2002 and at the 2006, because we had a chance for a medal, it was one of our presenting... Our afternoon presenting position came from the curling and I was the presenter. Of course, the rest of the day, when I wasn't actually on screen and we were off skiing or whatever, I'm watching the curling and I'm sitting with Doogie Donnelly and Kirsty Hay and so I was listening and watching and so I had a little bit of... And then in 2010, about 2 months before the Olympics, I got that call that said, we're going to be presenting from the curling as well again, great, but we need a new commentator because Doogie Donnelly was going. And I went, no. So I went, yeah, well, who's that going to be? And they said, well, we thought you could do both. I said, what? Anyway, so I did two things. I said, right, can I have Rona? Rona Martin was the gold medalist in 2002. And I'd got to meet Rona. I said, I need a co-commentator who, you know,
knows her stuff.
So what do you do then? You have to be really careful. So going back, I borrowed a little bit from myself. Remember I said I don't know anything about the pole vault. I know more than you, probably.
Yeah.
And I know a lot more now than I did, than I used to. But actually, so what you do is you learn to kind of go, what do I need to know to that I can at least broadcast something here? And I'm not going to try and be clever.
Mm.
Curling is like chess come, yeah, they're thinking four, five shots ahead, yeah?
Yeah.
There are nuances on the ice. There's so much technical stuff which we don't see. People think brushing's funny, you know. No, there's so much there. And they... terminology, each shot has a word, has a, you know, and you've got to watch for the outturn, you've got to watch for the intern, you're the timing to a thousandth of a second, the speed that they could, and you, until you get into this, but again, that's what fascinated me, you know, that I found it's a great television sport, it's why people tune in for the Winter Olympics, it's a square, it's like,
I remember that 2006 one,
it's like snooker, you know, it's in its basic form, it looks straightforward to understand, isn't it? Get as close as you can. Who's got the ones closest? But the intricacies. So I had to learn with commentary on that not to. And I'm much more confident. And the hallelujah moment the last games in when we're in South Korea. And Jackie Lockhart's my commentator now. And again, good double act. And Jackie and I have worked last two Olympics and she's brilliant. And I contradicted her. On a shot that I was like, you know, what are they going to do here? And she said, well, I think they're going to play an out turn, come through here. You know, and I went, why wouldn't they do X and X and X? You know? And she looked at me, you know, and she went...
As if to say, oi.
And she went, yeah. And guess what? They played the shot, which I suggested. And I was like, yes, I've arrived.
I've
got
it.
After three Olympics of commentating, I feel it's more having the confidence to say it on air.
Good on you.
But yes, I think, look, all commentary. Could I commentate my cats having a fight outside? Yes. You know, could I commentate a sport I don't know anything about? Yes. If it involved, here's the names of the people taking part. Here's what it is. He won, you know, she came second, whatever it was. Could I give you that in-depth? No. And this was going back to the Eurosport days. And we'll get to the end of this, but it's often good to go back to the beginning. I was warned to not hang around in the commentators often too long. So if we were doing it off tube, there was a big office at TF1 in which was Eurosport's European headquarters, French television. And you'd be sitting in there prepping your athletics. You're going on air at 5 o'clock. You've got there, you're doing all your stuff and you're waiting to go in a booth. And at 3:30, somebody comes running in the office, right? And goes, any English commentators? Any English commentators? And I used to put my hand up and he'd go, right, tractor pulling. The guy hasn't turned up. Can you come in and do the tractor pulling? Or something like that.
Yeah.
And it happened to me once and I never ever did it again. So because, yes, you can commentate it, but you're just going to end up. And to give you an example, I remember once one poor lad who did step in at Eurosport because they lost the line to us at the live event. We could hear and we could still hear this, them back in Paris. And he got pulled in from the – and we sent our notes on a fax.
Okay.
And of course, number 473 in the 1500 meters, it was James Kipketer or something, pacemaker.
Yeah.
And he spent a good 45 seconds talking about the fact this Kenyan runner was fitted with a pacemaker in his heart. And wasn't great. It was, well, you know, if you've never.
Brilliant.
I know. So, yes, I think what else would I like to do? I wouldn't now take on anything else until I was fairly confident I could do something other than just read the names out and, yeah.
Yeah, but football would be one
would
of those.
Be there. I mean,
just before the very last one, I mean, you sort of, you say it there so passively in a way that it made me sort of feel like I needed to tap into it. And it almost could have been one of the earlier questions. But the fact that you say, if it was my cats fighting outside, I could commentate on that. And if it was that, I could commentate on that. You know, your life was as a middle distance runner and that side of it. And then you needed a career afterwards. Like there's something within you that is very comfortable commentating. Where does that come from, do you think?
I don't know, because I wasn't, as a kid, I was fairly shy, I think is the right word. Everyone around me these days will tell you, probably as this interview is shown, I don't mind talking, but I'm also quite quiet. You know, if I'm passionate about something, you'll get me going. And the other things, I'll just not engage in the conversation if it's not something, you know, just for the sake of it. I think what happened was... I'll be ever thankful. You know, athletics, being a successful athlete gives you a platform to, and it gives you a confidence in yourself that your opinions are okay to voice them, that it's, your self-esteem obviously is helped by having a successful career, but you become, I don't mind kind of telling people what I think, if you know what I mean. And actually there was a period in the mid-90s which was sort of concurrent with the commentary, which I think helped as well. As I started to wind down my career, I started to do a lot of corporate work. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in things like motivation. And I hadn't been in my career and I started reading things and realizing, because I was thinking, well, why was I good? You know, I was actually curious as to, because everyone just kept, Brendan, you say, oh, you're just super talented. And I thought, that's a bit, you know, I actually worked really hard at what I did. And it was, you know.
Yeah.
So I read a fair bit. And then I found myself really enjoying talking to business people, either in a presenting, you know, kind of talking to them, but then particularly Q&A. And I think those two things together were the next steps after competing, happened at the same time and both helped each other.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. It's been brilliant, Steve. One last question for you. As people are used to by now, the day comes as and when it will be, hopefully a long way to go yet, where you're calling your last event. It may be a one-off race. It could be you're allowed to pick, you know, a two-week event or a weekend, whatever it might be. What would be your, if you could choose it, the sort of swan song event you'd like to go out on?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think I inevitably start to think about those sort of things at this point. I turned 60 later this year and I love commentating. And if things continue the way they sort of are, the environment we're in and things, I don't mean coronavirus. I mean, you know, we still get sport on television, BBC, and athletics is still popular. But there's going to come a point where I will not enjoy it. And if I think that's the key. Now, whether or not I suddenly decide that 2 weeks before or a week before or a year before, with athletics, I woke up one day. That's why I never had a retirement race. I literally woke up one day in the winter of 94, 95 and said, I'm not doing this anymore. You know, too many injuries and whatever.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't surprise me if that happens with commentary.
Interesting.
That I suddenly go, nah, I'm not doing it anymore. And it will not be because I don't like athletics, because the process has become something I don't enjoy anymore. Because as you can tell, I probably always will like talking about athletics. And if I get to that point, that would really accelerate that decision. So, but yes, probably more likely is that I think it'd probably be two stages, and I have to hesitate to say this. So, for instance, I have no idea where the BBC and its future is going. It may well be that we don't have the rights to the Olympics after 2024, for instance.
Sorry, this is a fantasy question anyway, Steve.
It's a fantasy question.
This can be what you would choose.
Yeah. I think, I mean, inevitably I'd probably choose two things because we have two worlds,
you're allowed
don't
to.
We? No, we have two worlds. So a summer where, I finished at the Olympic Games. And 3 weeks later, I was at the Great North Run, and that was my last piece of commentary.
Nice. So it's got that local element to it as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very good. Well, I think, at one stage earlier in our conversation, you said you'd still like to go and find whoever it was at Eurosport that decided halfway through that ad break to cross to you early. It sounded almost like, they might be in for a beating or a telling off. But I think probably for all of the rest of our benefit, you should be buying them a beer whatever they taught you via those several lessons you got in 5 minutes of early broadcasting was enough to intrigue you to get it right, and also, as you said, to work pretty hard at doing it. It is brilliant that you are as synonymous with more sporting events beyond the ones that you earn medals for through your commentary. You're almost going to rival Miles Harrison for our longest Q commentator ever, which has been an absolute joy. I'm so pleased we were able to make the time. Steve Cram, continue doing what you do, and thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Nick. Cheers.
I'm only hoping that, like me listening back to that earlier, that time has absolutely flown by for you listening as well. I think my favourite bit of that was the lovely line Steve tells us about David Coleman talking about no one ever replaying great bits of presenting. How wonderful. My deepest thanks to Steve Cram and to Alison Kirbishley as well, for helping me line that up. Lovely people, and another memorable episode, I'm sure you'll agree. I hope you did enjoy it. Please do leave that review on iTunes if you can. It does mean an awful lot to me. And if you're on Twitter, well, do share your highlights and what resonated with you at Q Commentator or at Nick Heath Sport. I'll be back with the next episode very soon. But for now, take care. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.